Free, or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to start today by going back to the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. You've probably been hearing about the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children who've been finding their way to the U.S. from Mexico and Central America. Well, this has actually been going on for some time now. The Border Patrol has been seeing a huge increase recently. Apprehensions of unaccompanied children have nearly doubled from this time last year. And in the current fiscal year alone, more than 70,000 children are expected to be apprehended at the border. We wanted to talk about what happens next. So we've called upon Dana Lee Marks. She is an immigration judge based in San Francisco, and she's president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. And that's how she happened to be in Washington, D.C., where we caught up with her. Thanks so much for coming in, Your Honor.
Thank you for making time for me.
And I want to make clear for our listeners that you are an immigration judge. You are not speaking in behalf of the Justice Department. So with that being said, you know, we know that the Border Patrol and shelters are overwhelmed by this surge of unaccompanied children at the border. And I just wanted to ask, do you remember a point at which you asked yourself, what's going on here, at which this kind of increase became visible to you?
We felt a steady creep of cases going upward in terms of the numbers of unaccompanied minors that we see in our proceedings. But we have been in the midst of an incredible surge in caseload overall in the past 5 to 10 years.
5 to 10 years. So has it been a thing where all of a sudden it kind of just happened one day, or has it been kind of this kind of gradual thing, at which point, because as I mentioned, you're in touch with your colleagues because of your role as the president of the association. Was there a point at which you all turned to yourselves and said, what's happening here? Or was it obvious what was motivating this? Did you know what was motivating this huge increase in caseload?
We weren't able to tell what was motivating it, but we definitely saw the dramatic rise of caseload over the years. Since 2006, there's been a 117% rise in our pending caseload. The immigration judges now, 230 sitting immigration judges across the country, handle a docket of over 360,000 cases. So overall, our dockets are just enormous, causing delays of more than 578 days on average when people are non-detained, and causing tremendous pressure for us to reshuffle resources in order to address detainees to make sure that they are not incarcerated for lengthy periods of time.
Now, we spoke recently with Dallas Morning News staff writer Diane Solis. We talked to her last week. She's been covering this, and she explained that children at the border are treated differently depending on where they are from. Here's a short clip from our conversation.
Mexico, because it is contiguous to the U.S., it's part of a legal situation in which the children or the juveniles are simply sent back. The Central Americans are not. And the Central Americans who are apprehended and are unaccompanied and juvenile, they're taken into shelters, supposedly within 72 hours.
So what happens next if the children now are taken into custody? If they're, as we heard from Diane, the Mexican children are generally sent back immediately, but the Central American kids have to come before some administrative figure. Is that the case?
Well, you have this huge net of people being apprehended, both at the border and in interior, and a certain percentage of those cases flow into the immigration courts. There are certain procedures when someone is caught immediately at the border, or where someone has been removed previously, where they won't come to an immigration court. There are some administrative bypasses. But particularly in cases of vulnerable populations, such as unaccompanied minors, there is a requirement that within 72 hours they are connected to Health and Human Services individuals who try to help find safe placements for them, to reunite them with family members, legal or illegal. And the Department of Homeland Security has to make a decision at that time whether they issue a charging document and file it with the immigration courts, which is what triggers the responsibility of the immigration judges to begin to move to action.
What happens when a child appears before you as a judge? What do you want to know? I mean, are most of these children, what do they want? Are they seeking to be reunited with a relative who's already here? Are they seeking asylum?
Any immigration proceeding before the immigration court has two components. And the first is, do you have a legal right to be in the United States? And that's often pretty short and sweet because people don't have a claim to be here legally. But the second part is whether there's any immigration benefit that they can qualify for under the law. Do they deserve protection because they would be persecuted in their home country? Asylum. Do they have family members with whom they can be reunited and perhaps eventually get a relative petition that would sponsor them? Are they unaccompanied minors who are at risk of abuse? And can they qualify for special immigrant juvenile status?
So if you're just joining us, we are speaking about the influx of unaccompanied children at the U.S.-Mexico border. We're talking about the role of immigration judges here. Joining us now is Dana Lee Mark. She is the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She is an immigration judge. She just wants to make clear that she's not speaking on behalf of the Justice Department in her capacity right now. You know, people are asking themselves, why now? Why is this huge influx of children coming now? Some of it seems to be based on rumor that children will be, in fact, allowed to stay. But a lot of the kids who are old enough to speak for themselves are saying they're fleeing gang violence. They are fleeing gang recruitment. They say that they have a choice. Either they join a gang and face what that all involves, or they're going to be killed. Does that qualify them for asylum? Is that a legitimate basis for asylum?
That's one of the very thorny issues for these children who are not entitled to an appointed attorney. Unlike the criminal justice system, where every person who comes before a judge has a legal right to have an appointed attorney if they can't afford one, immigration proceedings are considered civil in nature, even though the people there are not voluntarily there. So they don't have a legal right to appointed counsel. And when they try to make a claim for asylum, it can be very difficult because there's about five different statutory components to meeting the definitions required to qualify for asylum. And the thorniest is this nexus requirement. No matter how seriously you've been harmed in the past, something may be serious enough to amount to persecution, you have to show that it's on account of a protected statutory basis. And these gang cases fall into an evolving area of the law, something called a particular social group. Mm-hmm. Most of these claims are not based on traditional bases that we all kind of know and recognize easily, like political opinion or religion or race or nationality. Mm-hmm. Those are much easier to define. Particular social group is included in the definition, but it's not clear whether someone who's been singled out and targeted by a gang is going to qualify under the very complicated requirements of being a particular social group who their government either cannot control or their government is acquiescing in their persecution.
How many of these children are accompanied by lawyers? How many of these children have lawyers?
I don't know if the statistics have been broken out for juveniles, but overall, 40% of the people in immigration proceedings nationwide do not have attorneys, and 85% of people who are detained do not.
As I mentioned, your meeting with your fellow immigration judges is part of your portfolio as president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. What are they talking about this right now? Do they have a request of the Justice Department? Do they have an ask? What are they saying would alleviate the situation or at least help make it better?
For more than a decade, we have been the canary in the minefield, singing ourselves hoarse, trying to explain that there's a scarcity of resources that prevents us from being able to be nimble in these situations, to have adequate resources to devote to these kinds of emergency situations. The National Association of Immigration Judges actually advocates that we be taken out of the United States Department of Justice and be configured as a separate court, an Article I court, which would be like the tax court or the bankruptcy court. We feel that the stream of resources to the courts have been impeded by the fact that we are housed in a law enforcement agency. And admittedly, that's a technical legal argument that doesn't capture America's attention. But we feel it's a long-term structural reform that actually needs to be implemented in order to avoid crises such as these.
Where would you be housed then? To what entity would you be belong? Would you become part of the Department of Homeland Security? Would you be
would you be independent?
Like the tax court.
Right. And only our administrators might be housed in something like the Department of State.
Interesting. Finally, I don't know if this question makes you uncomfortable, what I'm to ask. Is there oftentimes as a person kind of in the middle of the stream. I've heard other judges say that there are just cases that haunt them. And I just wonder if there's a case that's haunting you at the moment.
There are some heartbreaking cases. What you can do as a judge to deal with that is to try to do the best you can for the person in front of you. There are times we all are very frustrated by the restraints put on us by the law. The judges have been advocating that we be given more discretion, that instead of rigid rules set out by Congress, that broader categories and policies be spelled out and allow the people in the trenches, the judges in the fields, to make those calls based on all the unique facts and circumstances of an individual case.
What you're saying is that the discretion you have in this area is actually fairly limited.
That is correct.
Okay, so asking again, is there a case that sticks with you where your discretion was limited, where it just was difficult for you? Was it because of time constraints or information constraints that you felt you just weren't sure? Do you mind?
Personally, I had a 10-year-old Honduran boy whose several family members, aunts, uncles, cousins, had been killed by gangs and who was sent by his family to the United States. And fortunately for him, he was in San Francisco, where we have a very engaged pro bono community. He had an excellent attorney. I granted his case, but was reversed on appeal because the appellate board felt that the law had been pushed beyond the appropriate limits.
And what happened to them? Do you know? He was deported?
He's still in process, So I'm not sure. Hmm.
Dana Lee Marks is an immigration judge based in San Francisco. She's speaking to us in her capacity as president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, and she joined us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Your Honor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, Ethan Swan is a basketball fan and an artist and has a few tattoos, so he started wondering why all the haterade directed at players with ink.
Every website that covers sports has done a 20 worst tattoos in basketball, 20 stupidest decisions with a tattoo, that kind of thing. And on that level, it's a judgment that I don't really understand.
We'll hear more about his project tracking NBA tattoos. That's ahead from Tell Me More on NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
This week on Latino USA.
My childhood, the way I remember my childhood, is that I spend my days afraid of extraterrestrials coming to my house and taking me with them.
The bright side and challenges of growing up. And some multicultural kids' books, too. That's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. Join me and my panel of experts each week as we discuss lawn and gardening care tailored to Zone 5 growing conditions. We'll also answer your gardening questions, so call in during the show or send an email for us to answer on the air. Join me for Mid-American Gardener Thursday nights at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday mornings at 6:30 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we'd like to talk about two international stories you may be following. We're talking about violent attacks in Kenya and Nigeria. On Tuesday, 13 people were killed by a bombing at a World Cup viewing center in Nigeria. And earlier this week, 15 people were killed by gunmen at a market in northern Nigeria. Both attacks are suspected to have been carried out by Boko Haram. That's that Islamist militant group that's claimed responsibility for the kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in April. And these latest attacks are causing critics to ask again if the government led by President Goodluck Jonathan is up to the task of handling this crisis in Nigeria. Meanwhile, in the East African country of Kenya, at least 57 people are dead after a series of attacks along the country's coast. The Islamist group Al-Shabaab claims responsibility for those attacks, even warning tourists to visit, quote, at their own peril. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta claims that those attacks were carried out, though, not by Al-Shabaab, but by local political networks and criminal gangs. For more on what's been going on in these two countries, we are turning to James Schneider. He is the editor-in-chief for the online magazine Think Africa Press, and he's with us now from London. James Schneider, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Could we start with Kenya? We have heard, of course, in the past there have been, you know, political violence. We've heard about, you know, Al-Shabaab particularly operating along the borders there. What do we know about that? Do you have a sense of whether it was in fact Al-Shabaab or not?
Well, it's unclear, but the government's position doesn't seem entirely consistent. So to begin with, they were saying that it was Al-Shabaab, and they're the spokesman for the military, which is fighting against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Said that it was Al-Shabaab, and now they've changed their tune and they've said that it's political. But they started off by saying it was political more in the sense of party political rather than what they're saying now, which is sort of local land dispute between different ethnic groups. They don't have a lot of credibility with knowing precisely what happens in attacks. If you remember the Westgate shopping mall attack, where, you know, they first of all said that there were lots of foreign fighters. There were some British and American there. That turned out to not be the case. There was the suggestion from the foreign minister that possibly Samantha Lathwaite, the so-called White Widow, was amongst the attackers. And even when they released the names of the attackers, they got them off a bogus Twitter account purporting to be from Al-Shabaab. So when they say they have a lot of intelligence suggesting it's one particular thing, we have to take that with a bit of a pinch of salt.
If it is Al-Shabaab, does this latest attack tell us something about their intentions or their tactics at this point or their targets or motivations?
Yes, if it is Al-Shabaab, it's a sort of refining of their process. So part of the reason why apparently Al-Qaeda core and Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri were unsure about whether they wanted to ally with Al-Shabaab was because its leader, Gaddafi, has been so violent and they've killed so many Muslims in Somalia. And then in Westgate, there was apparently some of the time they were asking people, could they recite a verse from the Quran? And if they couldn't, they were killing them. And other times they were killing people indiscriminately and also killing women and children. Here, what seems to have happened is they've gone door to door asking, one, can anyone recite a verse from the Quran? And then two, taking generally young men, sort of fighting age men, and not killing women and children. So if this is Al-Shabaab, it suggests that they've taken on board the criticisms they got from within the kind of international jihadi networks, which said they were indiscriminately killing and they were killing too many Muslims.
What have they announced a motivation for this? Do we have any sense of what their ultimate goal is?
So they say it's in response, just like Westgate was, and there's actually been a spate of other attacks around the country, but on a smaller scale over the past year. It's in response to Kenya's invasion of Somalia to combat Al-Shabaab, which started in October 2011. Sadly, ironically, in response to kidnappings by Al-Shabaab of tourists and other people in this part of the country, up in this northeast of the country.
Let's turn to Nigeria now, and we've heard about these latest attacks, which just reinforce, I think, the sense of kind of chaos and disorder that I think a lot of people are experiencing after the kidnapping of those schoolgirls, which, of course, has become a matter of kind of international attention. There has been this discussion about whether or not there should be negotiations with Boko Haram. I mean, previously the president said he would not negotiate. He has appealed for help from, you know, bordering countries and, you know, from allies and addressing this. But has there been any discussion around this whole question of negotiation? Where are those talks?
There has been, and for the last sort of 5 years that Boko Haram has operated, there have been sort of on-again, off-again so-called negotiations, but it's always been slightly unclear who they've been with. So a certain figure will pop up and say that he's a Boko Haram negotiator, and they have some negotiations with him, and then nothing comes of it. And I think they're basically unsure of what their position should be. They, you know, Goodluck Jonathan and his administration know that they absolutely have to bring the girls back. It's in the context of a presidential election coming up relatively early next year. But at the same time, they know that AQIM further north in Mali and in Algeria have been funding themselves from kidnappings, and that perhaps their international partners, especially Britain and the US, will not look kindly to them paying to having this large prisoner exchange.
And finally, these latest attacks, again, the killings, as we said, of the 13 people at this World Cup viewing center, and then this bombing at the market. Is there anything that we can draw from those attacks, either about, you know, methods, intentions, motivations? What was the purpose of them?
Not really. I mean, it fits into their kind of broad schema of attacking local population. I mean, they have evolved, but this right now, what we've just seen in the last couple of days, is not an evolution. They now target the local population far more than they used to, because they now see the local population as enemies, because they have, in many places, especially Maiduguri, which is the capital of Borno State, which is the kind of locus of this, have risen up against them, whilst beforehand they more attacked police stations and traditional leaders.
Hmm. James Schneider is the editor-in-chief for Think Africa Press. We reached him in London. James Schneider, thanks so much for speaking with us. The NBA Finals ended on Sunday with a victory for the San Antonio Spurs. And while many of us have debated the merits of age versus swagger and Michael versus LeBron, did you stop to ask yourself, which team has the most tattoos? It turns out that the Heat win the tattoo index. 60% of the Heat are tatted up, compared to 43% of the Spurs. How do we know? Why, Ethan Swan's online database, of course. It's called NBA Tattoos. For the past four seasons, Ethan Swan has been documenting the league's tattoos, which he says now adorn at least 55% of the league's players. If you're wondering why he does it and why it matters, well, he's with us now. Ethan Swan, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor.
How did you get started on this?
I guess 2010, I bought League Pass for the first time, which is like a subscription service. And I guess at the time, I didn't realize how much basketball I was going to be watching. I'd usually watch two a night. And then there's just these kind of recurring questions that come up, especially when you're watching these mid-season, less interesting games, of kind of, how many people do have tattoos? And I thought it would be a statistic that would be really easy to find, but then nobody had really come up with a definitive answer. So it was kind of more rumor, and I thought, there's 30 teams, there's 15 guys on a team, that's 450 people. It shouldn't be that hard to just sit down and say, does this guy have tattoos or not, especially if I'm watching a couple games every night and everything is so visible in the games.
So it became a quest.
Yes, a quest. Absolutely, yeah.
And you're an artist yourself. I know you run a gallery. I mean, I'm just wondering why tattoos as opposed to, you know, how many guys are invested in Walmart or something like that. I mean, there's lots of things that one might want to know.
Sure. That's a great point. You know, my wife and I used to talk about the guys that wear zero, and if there was a certain kind of energy that makes a person choose the jersey number zero. That's another thing that's a little bit tough to find that information. But with tattoos, you know, it's like you said, I'm heavily involved in art. So to me, so much of art is about the creation of meaning through image. All the same images exist, the basketball, the cross, the RIP tattoo, these kind of really basic categories of tattoo that exist in the NBA. But then you see how these 450 guys, a little more than half of which have tattoos, they're each individually creating meaning. And for me, on a bigger level, I think basketball is very much about personality. I think that's why I'm drawn to it more than other sports. You see friendships, you see rivalries. There's so much visible on the court with players that tattoos became another way for me to kind of think about these personalities.
So let's do two different categories. A lot of these tattoos really are rooted in pain, right? In pain, painful stories, right? So
absolutely.
Who's got the most heartbreaking tattoo?
I've said before on the blog that Randy Foy, the portrait of his mother he has tattooed over his heart, who, you know, when he was 3 years old, his mother left the family. He's never seen her since. But to him, it's really kind of almost this act of forgiveness of saying, if my mother were in my life, she would be so important to me. So I'm trying to replicate that experience or show how important she could be to me. And
that is heartbreaking, right, on every level. And what about just for fun? There are just for fun tattoos, right?
There are tons of just for fun tattoos. I think, you know, one of the ones that always jumps out to me is Wilson Chandler on his leg has just a ton of cartoon characters like Beavis and Butthead or some of the characters from Aqua Teen Hunger Force. I'm probably 10 years older than him, so a lot of the cartoon references aren't meaningful to me. But again, it's this creation of meaning of this is a thing that's important to me and I'm going to wear it on my leg.
Why do you think that tattoos have become so much a part of the NBA style these days? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think some of it traces back to Allen Iverson. Obviously, he wasn't the first tattooed player, but something about Iverson's defiance, tenacity, and drive. You see, a lot of players really do look up to him, and you actually will find many quotes from players who say, I got my first tattoo because Allen Iverson has a tattoo. Somebody like Nate Robinson, for example, said, my first tattoo is a bulldog that I got when I was 13 because of Allen Iverson's bulldog.
Yeah, one of the other points, though, that I heard you make, though, is that there has been a lot of negative judgment around these tattoos. Do you think that's true?
I think negative association is a really great way to put it. Of course, when I sat down to start doing the work, a lot of what I do is just search for players on the internet, search for images, or search for interviews where they talk about their tattoos. And a side effect of that, every website that covers sports has done a 20 worst tattoos in basketball, 20 stupidest decisions with a tattoo, that kind of thing. And on that level, it's a judgment that I don't really understand, but it gets so much deeper when critics try to use it as a way to talk about a player's character. You know, I know you guys are in Washington, D.C., where John Wall plays, and John Wall, one of my most favorite players in the league. When he came into the league, there was a great Washington Post article about him where he talks about his relationship with his father, which is another really heartbreaking, intense thing to follow. And he said, I probably won't get any tattoos because I don't want to mess up any opportunities to get sponsorships. And he said, but if I were to get a tattoo, I would get a tribute to my father. And at the end of last season, the 2012-2013 season, he covered his chest and I think his back as well with tattoos. And somebody, another sports writer in D.C. said, this is why you can't trust this guy. This is why he won't be the leader of this team, because he went back on this promise about getting tattoos. And I think holding a 23-year-old responsible for something he said when he was 20 is absurd. Again, his tattoo is super personal. He's got a tribute to Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where he grew up, and these kind of heavenly creatures. And so I don't understand. You know, it's sports, it's analytics. There's so many ways to judge these guys. You can look at how they score. You can look at how they pass. I mean, that's the whole terrain of sports, right, is judging someone based on the decisions they're making on the court. So the idea of using this kind of arbitrary side activity as a way to judge them just seems ludicrous to me.
You have some tattoos yourself.
It's true.
I take it, yeah. And what are yours about?
Well, I think tattoos are a great way to mark pain in a lot of ways. You know, I have a tattoo of a rabbit. I had a pet rabbit that I lived with for 10 years that I got shortly after his death, like a portrait of him. I have a tattoo that says absent friends. A tattoo that I got in celebration that has since kind of turned its energy is I have a tattoo of a rooster, and in the rooster's beak is the letter J for my sister Jordana. My sister died about a year and a half ago now. And so it has this kind of different way that I think about it, about her presence or her continued importance in my life.
Mm, I'm sorry about Thanks. Your sister. Do you think your tattoos kind of connect you to those guys in some way? I mean, you're not 7 foot tall, but you do have some tats. You got some ink.
Well, I think that, one of the tattoos I've been thinking so much about lately is Tyson Chandler, who plays for the Knicks, and this goes back to the Allen Iverson thing. When Tyson Chandler came into the league, he had a copy of an Allen Iverson tattoo, which was a cross that said around it, only the strong survive. And this past year, Tyson Chandler, who's now 32, had all the lettering that spells out only the strong survive crossed out, just with a single line. So it's still readable, but it's just struck through. And there's a great interview with him online where he says, you know, this isn't a thing I believe anymore. I'm older. I have a different definition of strength. I think very differently about what these things mean. And I don't know that I want to walk around with this on my arm anymore, but I also want to make clear that this was a thing that was important to me, and now I've changed. And I think that that aspect of marking a change, of marking a thing that was important, you know, I have a lot of tattoos that I've done myself that are, you just do with like a sewing needle and India
ink. Okay, you're telling me more than I want to know. Sorry. That's okay. You're crossing my comfort level there. Thank you. Okay. But anyway, go ahead. You were saying, finish your thought.
Oh, sure. But the but those stick and pokes, you know, they were done at kind of lower times in my life, and I'm glad I have them because I do think they mark this thing that I just can look at and say, wow, that was in 2005, that was a tough year, you know, and I think that in that way, watching these players' biographies unfold in this way through the tattoos that they get, I think is really nice for me to think about the way that my tattoos or the people I care about that have tattoos unfold in that similar way.
Ethan Swan's blog is called NBA Tattoos. He also runs a gallery in downtown Los Angeles. We caught up with him at our bureau in Culver City, California. That's NPR West. Ethan Swan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. It's really a treat.
Coming up, American soccer fans are still riding high after the U.S. underdogs beat a past nemesis, Ghana, at World Cup earlier this week. But some Spanish-speaking fans have not been pleased with some of the color commentary they've been hearing on Univision, calling it off-color and even racist. We'll hear more from commentator Felix Sanchez, who took his beef straight to the network. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Jeff Dyer tells us about his 2 weeks on the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush. Last week, the ship was ordered to the Persian Gulf to support military efforts in Iraq. Dyer's new book is called Another Great Day at Sea. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
In 1913, this piece of music, this one right here, caused a riot.
They screamed, there was blood.
All simply because of air pressing against your ear.
This week on Radiolab, we ask why. And try and figure out what is it exactly about music that can sometimes drive people mad.
Literally mad.
Saturdays at 2 on AM 580.
Today's programming is brought to you in part by Courage Connection and by Connections Thrift Store. Transitions Thrift Store is now Connections. Connections carries gently used clothing, housewares, and furniture. Open Monday through Saturday in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. Courage Connection. Together, we have courage.
Yeah.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Later, we'll talk about tightening up our game on our wedding etiquette. But first, speaking of manners, we want to talk about some language that's gotten attention at World Cup. Some critics are saying the language used by some of the announcers is just rude and wrong. One of the people calling attention to this is a person we've met before. His name is Felix Sanchez. He's co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. And you might remember that he previously called attention to the scarcity of Latino artists who've received Kennedy Center honors. More recently, writing on the social media site Facebook, Mr. Sanchez has said some of the announcers on the Spanish language network Univision are using racist and sexist and outdated language. Equally interesting, though, is that Univision seems to be paying attention. And Felix Sanchez stopped by our studios in Washington, D.C. to tell us more about his concerns. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about some of the examples you highlighted in your post. Say, in the Costa Rica versus Uruguay match on Saturday, an announcer referred to a player as Moreno, which translates to black or brown. Why was this offensive?
Well, you know, it shows that when the announcers were talking about it, the other players, they used their last names. And then when it came to an Afro-Costa Rican player, they used the color of his skin as a way to define him and to also use another word that, you know, reflected their kind of misunderstanding of his hairstyle, which was in dreads. And they used the word greña in referring to it. And it was gratuitous.
Which is messy hair.
Which is, you know,
it's not
insulting.
So it's like referring to the guy as like the black guy.
The black guy
or the guy with the hair as opposed to his name. Which
exactly.
They could certainly understand. What about some of the language referring to women? You didn't appreciate that.
They also, in panning the audience, would say, you know, mira las chulas. And, you know, it has a very kind of earthy, sexualized, you know, context to it. And I think that the concern, I mean, what happens, and the reason that we're having this conversation is that when you have something like the World Cup occurring, the reason that Univision is winning ratings over ESPN is because many English-leaning Latinos go back to wanting to have a more authentic experience by watching the games on Univision. And then what happens is you see the lack of social progress that is exhibited by sportscasters. And again, it gives us an opportunity to make these changes.
But one of the things that's noteworthy, though, is you also pointed this out in a subsequent post, is that you posted this. You weren't the only person, but you might be the best well-known person or a person sort of known as an activist. The president of Univision Sports actually called you during a high-profile match. Do you mind telling us about that conversation?
And there I give them total credit. And I also want to, you know, put in context that this doesn't rise to a level of a Donald Sterling kind of commentary. But there's a sensitivity that they understand is missing. And I got a phone call from the president of Univision Sports from Brazil during the U.S. match. And it was really a very, very heartfelt reaching out to basically say, look, we want to hear more about this and we want to understand this and we want to get our team to appreciate these differences.
Did he apologize? He didn't apologize, but he seemed to understand what you were saying. He wasn't defensive. He didn't say, what are you talking about, Felix?
No. What I appreciate is that they immediately saw an issue and they wanted to address it. And they extended an invitation for me to come to Miami to visit with him and the team that was doing the presentations during the World Cup.
But this is after World Cup. What about during World Cup?
Well, I have a direct line to them to express any other concerns that viewers might see or reflect.
What about the broadcasters themselves or any of the announcers themselves? Had you heard from any of them? Did they seem to hear what you were saying?
Well, you know, the problem is that they are, you know, broadcasting almost, you know, 18 hours a day, and they're not really the direct line to me was to speak to their boss. Mm-hmm. And if their boss is aware, I think they will hear about it
What do you think this says? We have about a minute left. You know, it's interesting that, you know, the popular comedian and talk show host Ellen DeGeneres, you know, people were not pleased that she tweeted during the U.S.-Ghana match. She says, well, this gives me time to look up where Ghana is. Some people weren't pleased about that. What do you think that this says, the fact that you got a response so quickly? Do you think it's because you're you and because you have a previous record of activism, or what do you think it says something bigger than that?
Well, I think that clearly we have a relationship. And clearly they want to understand what English language leaning Latinos experience. But in contrast to what we raised in issues to Saturday Night Live and their lack of hiring a Latina cast member in 39 seasons, every major Latino organization wrote Lorne Michaels. We have yet to get an answer from them, far more severe as a kind of an issue. And yet you're seeing that we have room to grow on both sides of this equation.
So people are listening. People are learning more about actually who is in their audience, right? Felix Sanchez is the co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. He was nice enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Keep us posted. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Switching gears now. It's wedding season. You might be invited to a wedding or two or three. Yesterday, we talked about how engaged couples should start talking about money before the wedding. So if you'd like to catch up on that conversation, go to npr.org. So about that wedding, it is one of the more stressful events in a person's life. And why is that? Well, could it be because people don't know how to behave? So we've brought back two of our favorite guides on how to behave to get us all straightened out when it comes to wedding etiquette. They will also answer some of the questions you've been tweeting us. And with us now, once again, are Stephen Petro. He writes the advice column Civilities for The Washington Post, and he's also author of Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us once again, Karen Grigsby Bates. She's author of the etiquette book, Basic Black, Home Training for Modern Times. She's also an NPR correspondent. Karen Grigsby Bates, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Michelle.
So let me just start by asking you, Karen, maybe you'll start us off here. What are some of the questions that come up over and over again?
One of the top ones people always say is, I got an invitation to Thus and So's wedding, and I don't think I'm going to be able to go. Do I have to send a present?
Really? Why do you think that's the thing that comes up over and over again?
Because times are tough economically. People are worried about it. And weddings tend to come in clumps. And we're right at the beginning of the start of serious business wedding season. So I'd say from sort of mid-May to about late August, early September, there's going to be a lot of that going on.
So what's the answer to that question?
Well, I've always said that a wedding invitation is not a quid pro quo. It's not like you buy a ticket to go to the wedding by giving somebody a toaster. and the whole business of wedding presents started out when people used to live with their parents until they got married. So they didn't have any stuff. You know, your mom had all the stuff. Now, couples often live together or they've been working for a while and they bought things that they like. And so maybe they don't need or want as much stuff. Sometimes what I've seen in registries is people saying, the thing I really, really want, I'm saving up for, but if you guys want to contribute to my super duper mixer, I'd love to have that. Fine.
But to the question of people saying, do I have to send a present? Your answer is no, you don't have to.
No, you do not have to send a present.
Okay. Stephen Petro, what about you? What's your answer to that?
Presents are really voluntary, but I think in this case, because so many couples imbue them with emotion and love, it's a great idea to give some kind of gift. It's a symbolic gesture.
And Stephen, you write about changing manners in a number of circumstances. You write about kind of the changing social mores. I mean, the fact that people are entering new territory and with same-sex weddings, and many people, this is new. This is kind of a new experience, and they feel uncertain there. And you also write about changing digital manners. What are some of the questions that come up for you most often?
Well, among same-sex couples and those invited to same-sex weddings, it really is. It's new territory, and I kind of see my role as a manners advice columnist as a psychotherapist for helping people get through these anxiety fraught moments. And so for gays and lesbians, there's the question, you know, are mom and dad going to help pay? Usually not, because as Karen just mentioned, these couples tend to have been together for a while. They've got stuff, and they can afford their own wedding. For parents, there are lots of questions. Again, will they be paying? But also, will dad be dancing with his son doing the first dance? No, that's not usually the case. Will the parents be escorting the couple, the same-sex couple, down the aisle? Sometimes. It's a beautiful symbolic gesture, but many of these couples also have been together. They like the symbolism of escorting or walking themselves down the aisle.
Stephen, you wrote recently in one of your columns, it's actually a very emotional issue, I think, for many people, which is the question of family members who have not necessarily been accepting of their relationship. And then the question arises when the wedding, if the couple does go forward and they decide to solemnize their relationship and make that commitment, should they invite a family member, a close family member, who has not been particularly supportive in the past. And you had an answer that I think surprised a lot of people. Some people were not thrilled with it. Do you want to tell us what you said?
I'd be happy to. And you're right. Many people were not thrilled. So in this particular instance, the woman who wrote in, she had told her parents that she was getting married to her fiancé, and that's fiancé with two E's. And they did not say congratulations. They did not really respond in any way. And so now they were debating whether or not to invite their parents. And my answer was yes. Take the high road. Embrace them. This is what families do. And my advice to the parents was, accept. It does not mean that you need to go vote for same-sex marriage in your state. It doesn't mean that you're giving money to Freedom to Marry. It just means that you're there to support your daughter. But I would say it was 50-50 the response. Many people agreed and think that, as I do, that the way to change hearts and minds is to invite people to a wedding. I mean, who has not been to a wedding and, you know, gotten, you know, teary-eyed and so on? So I think people do understand, you know, it's about love and commitment. But many others felt that you should not be extending this olive branch. This couple had been rebuked already and should not put themselves in the line of fire again.
Karen, I'm wondering if this question has arisen also with interracial marriages.
And not just race. This is something that transcends a whole bunch of different situations. And my thought is the same as Stephen's. You know, invite people and assume that they will come if they're comfortable, that they won't if they aren't, and let them know that you expect them to come and be part of a celebration, not to sit there dour-faced and censorious as you walk down the aisle. I think if people were going to do that, they wouldn't come. And I think what I've discovered is that lots of times when people say, I'd never do that, I don't sanction it, blah, 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 after a while they start thinking, well, it is my kid. And so they come and they think, you know, all right, fine, I'm going to come because it's the polite thing to do. And then, as Stephen says, get themselves caught up in it because it's your child and you want your child to be happy. And so if someone is next to your child who is pledging to love him or her and protect him or her and, you know, serve him or her all the days of his or her life, then that makes you a little verklempt.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are talking about wedding etiquette. We are talking with two of our trusted advisors on matters of etiquette. We're talking with Karen Grigsby Bates and Stephen Petro. Okay, what about the whole question of, we were talking earlier, Karen, about saving money. A lot of people to save money have been going the paperless route, and not just saving money. For some people, it's an ethical issue. They feel like if you can save the paper, why not save the paper? So where are you on the digital invitation?
Oh, I'm afraid I am not in favor of the digital wedding invitation. For birthday parties, sure. For potlucks, fine. For alumni get-togethers, no problem. I think weddings are different. You know, they're imbued with this sense of ceremony. They're looked at as milestones. That's something that me, fogey that I am, would like to keep. And so I would like my wedding invitation to arrive in the mail with a stamp and a response envelope that also has a stamp on it.
Okay. Lightning round, folks. Lightning round on this one. These are from our Twitter followers. Liz in Ann Arbor. Karen, this is for you. Liz in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wants to know how to handle a family member scheduling her wedding 2 weeks before hers. And this is after Liz sent out the save the dates. Does she have anything to say to her? What should she say, if anything?
She should say congratulations and don't worry about it, because I'm assuming that these weddings are in two different and, you know, far apart places. The people who got her invitation who want to be there, they're going to come to her wedding. Some people may be able to come to both, but her friends will be there.
All right, Stephen, another Twitter question for you. Jenna in Syracuse, New York says, do I have to choose a maid of honor? I'm hesitant to pick a favorite out of my three best friends.
No, Jenna does not. Really, what maids of honor do are commanders in chief, and the more the merrier, and you'll just give them more tasks to do, and it'll be an easier wedding for you. So no decision need to be made that way.
And Stephen, going back to the question we talked about earlier, family members who have not been supportive of your relationship, and you're saying invite them anyway. I want to go back to how much resistance you got to that idea. What is your response to the people who adamantly disagreed? Did you have one?
I did. And what I saw really in those who disagreed with me was the amount of pain and hurt they had suffered from their family members. And that was very, you know, that was very meaningful to me too. And many of them explained the circumstances, how they got to be so isolated in their lives and how their families had not been there to support them during, during their whole roadmap. So I really could understand this pain. And I think that perhaps the best way to turn that pain into love is to invite them. But it really was it was very heartfelt on their part.
Hmm. Karen, finally, Bridezilla. If there is a Bridezilla in your world who keeps giving you orders and, demanding things and, bachelorette weekends in Vegas and things of, and just kind of a level of, obedience that you perhaps were not signed up for, what do?
I think you do what you can when you can, and the rest of it you have to let slide. It really, the Bridezilla's excuse is, this is the most important day of my life, and it has to be perfect. Well, if this is the most important day of your life, what does that say about the day your children are born, the day you get the advanced degree you want, the day you find out you're cancer-free? I mean, there are a lot of wonderful things, one hopes, that lie ahead for you, and the wedding is sort of a little punctuation point, but marriage may be, if you're lucky, for way longer than that. So focus more on the marriage, less on the wedding.
Steve, a final thought for you. Forgive me if this is sexist, but I don't hear that much about Groomzilla. Do you?
That is really a very funny question, Michelle, because I have been told by many of my gay male friends that within every same-sex couple, there is a male Bridezilla just waiting to come out.
So what's your advice to the person who asks you for advice about how to deal with Groomzilla? What do you say?
I think the best answer is that's the price of equality. We asked to get married to have that right. Now we have to deal with some of the downside,
okay.
the male Bridezilla.
Male Bridezilla. All right. Stephen Petro writes the advice column Civilities for the Washington Post. He's author of Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. We caught up with him at member station WUNC, which is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Karen Grigsby Bates is author of the etiquette book Basic Black, Home Training for Modern Times. She's an NPR correspondent, and she joined us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle. Hi, Karen.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.